Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Today we are having Bill Prickett, who is, I'm so honored to have him because he has been a volunteer for RFR for so long, and he has such an interesting backstory, and he's the perfect person to speak about conversion therapy.
Well, greetings everyone from Dallas. It's very nice to be with you. I love working with RFR. I have such respect for what the organization does, and the people that I've worked with are just amazing, and I'm honored to be any way associated with the group. So it's very exciting for me. As far as who I am, I was born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama, which is deep south, and I grew up in a very interesting period of history during the height of the civil rights movement, and got to witness a lot of that firsthand. I vividly remember the bombing of the Black Baptist Church. I remember the riots in downtown Birmingham. In fact, I was in a car with my family. We were going from one side of town to the other, and they diverted us around the city to keep us out of all of that. So my freshman year in high school was the first year of forced desegregation, the first time I ever went to school with Black students, with other Black children. So it was an all new thing. We had teachers at our high school who quit rather than teach Black students. So it was, you know, just kind of my first experience into people who had an experience of being judged because they were different and of being discriminated because they were different. Later in high school, I became editor of our school newspaper and was put on a council with other students. We were an interracial council, and I got to meet firsthand these Black students who were being forced into our high school, and I got to hear their stories and their fears and how terrified they were of this situation. I thought it was just us white kids who were confused and not sure what to do, but these kids, and so listening to their stories just changed my perspective and helped me to understand that not everybody has the same experience that I had growing up. But I think I knew from a very young age that I was not like other boys. And I think worse than that, I realized I liked other boys. And in the Southern culture that I was raised in, which is deeply religious and deeply ingrained with predefined gender roles and gender expectations, I learned early on that was unacceptable. I had a father, well, actually my biological father abandoned us when I was very young, and my mom remarried when I was about six. And I think my stepfather realized pretty quickly that he needed to do some work in my life. He needed to train the sissy out of me. So that became his mission. And he did that with taunting and teasing and verbal abuse. And so I learned very young, from 7, 8 years old, that certain mannerisms were not going to be acceptable, inflections, different aspects. So I began to learn to monitor how I presented myself to the world outside me. And so that kind of was my mindset going through life. And as I got older and these desires that were inside me began to become more prominent, I had to find more and more ways to confront those. When I got involved in the church, I was immediately told that these attractions inside me were sinful. I was an abomination. It would keep me out of the kingdom of God, all the negative messages. And so I wanted even more to get rid of these desires. And that's what led me into what's known today as conversion therapy. We didn't call it that back then. We called it ex-gay treatments because we wanted to become an ex-gay, to change from being a gay to being an ex-gay. So that's kind of how I got involved in it. I was involved in an incredibly, extremely fundamental organization when I was growing up. I mean, it was militaristic, misogynistic. I mean, it was probably for the time, it was run by a former colonel in the military. And so it was very, very nationalistic, patriotic, that kind of thing. But I learned very quickly that the feelings and the desires that I had were unacceptable. So in trying to find out what to do, I learned about these organizations that promised that they could fix me. And that's how I got involved in them. It became an 8-year journey in my life of desperately, diligently trying to overcome what I was feeling inside me.
It's a perfect presentation. I feel like it gives the perfect introduction to who you are and why you're here speaking about conversion therapy, because I think a lot of people could probably question, like, you know, why are we even speaking about this and why are we bringing this random person to this? Is because you have dealt with it. You have had a lifelong experience of what it is to be like in a conversion therapy session program, however you want to call it. So that's perfect. So I guess my first question would be, how did it all start? Like, who had the first idea of doing a conversion therapy? What sort of the background of it?
Okay. I think probably if we had the records historically, they've probably been trying to change people's sexual orientation for hundreds of years. What we do know is back in the 1800s, there was an actual documented case of a hypnotist, a German hypnotist, who claimed that he could cure homosexual desires by hypnosis. And he would do these, I guess what would amount to a Vegas show, where you'd bring them on stage, hypnotize them, then send them to hookers and prove that they had been cured. And so that's kind of what some historians say is the first example of somebody actually trying a process. But because for years the medical community and the mental health community viewed homosexuality as a mental disorder, Freud saw it that way, and most therapists did. It was listed in the American Psychiatric Association's list of mental health disorders. So it's always been treated as some kind of weakness, mental illness. And so there's been all kinds of forms of treatment. Some were in Freud, it was, you know, intensive psychotherapy, trying to find the root cause of it. And it's everything from your mother to Oedipal, whatever. But then some of them are historically more severe. Electroshock therapy, we have history of electroshock therapy, aversion therapy, even to the extreme of lobotomies were practiced in 1800s. To cure somebody, testicular transplants were practiced. Some doctors believed that a man was gay because it was in his testicles. So they would transplant the testicles from a heterosexual man. It's been practiced for hundreds of years. And as the medical profession caught up with the science, and as the gay and lesbian community, the LGBTQ community, began to push more and more of the reality of our lives, we were able to come to some changes. And then in the 70s, there was homosexuality was dropped as a mental disorder. And about that time, you began to have what we know as today's modern conversion therapy programs in Melody Land, Anaheim. A group of gay Christians began to meet together, just kind of talk to one another. Mm-hmm. They called themselves EXIT, which is Ex-Gay Intervention Team. And they just met together, and that became the foundation of what later became Exodus, which mm-hmm. was at the time the largest umbrella organization for ex-gay organizations in the world. They have now closed down and are no longer operational. There was an organization in up in the Pacific Northwest. That's the Love in Action was founded. That's the oldest and largest at the time organization. So they began to form. They're always around very conservative Christian faith because you need a very conservative Christian faith for an ex-gay conversion therapy program to flourish. So they then began to grow into other churches, each individual person. If I have an experience that I say, this changed my life, this changed me and helped me control my desires, then all of a sudden a ministry grows up around me. And I tell people, this is how you fix yourself. It's all done with Bible memorization. And then another person prays and prays and prays, and that cures their, they feel like that cures their desires. So they start a ministry and they say the way to cure is through prayer. And so you have all these groups growing up. There's no consistency with methodology. It's purely personality based, and it grows up around an individual's own experience. And there's not any oversight. Nobody is controlling who does anything because they're not medical professionals. 90% of the time or more, they're not mental health professionals. At most, they may be ordained ministers. Oftentimes, they're not even that. And so they grow these organizations around this personality. Mm-hmm. So you have somebody who has their own sexual struggles teaching other people who have their own sexual struggles. What could go wrong?
Right. So I guess the follow-up obvious question is, now that we have seen that it's not necessarily something that's positive for people who engage in conversion therapy, why is this not illegal in every single state of the US, you know, or in the majority of the world? Why is it still happening? You know, what does it make it continue?
I think the biggest thing is the religious influence. It is built on the premise of a religious concepts. Because conservative religion sees the homosexuality as a sin, and I don't want to get too technical here, but let me give you a little bit of framework. Because conservative Christians are convinced that homosexuality is a sin, they're convinced of that because they will tell you the Bible says that. Now, my theology training will tell you that I could argue that it says that. But given that they say it's a sin, so like other sins, it can be overcome. So because it's a sin, it can be overcome, and therefore it should be overcome. And so that's the premise that starts it. And so you, when you have, it should be illegal. It should be outlawed in every city, state, in every country, but it's not, because you still have these people. I've watched city council meetings and state legislators meeting, and you still have these people who will argue that we need to keep it in place because of their view of what a homosexual is, what a homosexual does, and or this whole, well, people believe this, so they ought to be free to practice their religious faith. So there's those kinds of barriers to changing it. But the problem, even if every state outlawed it, if the United States had a federal mandate that outlawed it, you're still not going to stop it because it's all religious based and is still going to be practiced in conservative churches. Until you change the mindset within a conservative Christian mindset, it's still going to be practiced.
Do these programs promise you to stop being part of the LGBTQ plus community, or does it promise like just to help you deal with those desires? Because I guess I think Christianity, I've never been a Christian, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Christianity assumes that you will always look at other people with lust. That is just the sin that we all have, and you're never going to get rid of that. You can only like fight against it, but you can't get rid of it. So my question is, does conversion therapy promise you to stop being gay, or does it promise you to help you with the attractions that you may feel to people of the same gender?
That it is a wonderful question, because what they promise is not always what they deliver. And their promises are oftentimes couched in really vague terminology. And so for years, they will say change is possible. And the implication is you can change from being gay to being straight. It's begun to, over the last 10 or 15 years, morph a little bit, so they won't nail themselves down to, we'll help you change from gay to straight. They will talk about leaving the homosexual lifestyle. They will talk about turning your back on homosexuality. And so there's a lot of nebulousness in their terminology as to what they promise. But some still will come out and say, you do not have to be gay. You do not have to be a lesbian. You can be the way God intended. And so they will, it's not that you will stop having lust or sexual feelings, but the fact that you have sexual feelings toward a person of the same sex is an aberration, is an abnormality, it is unnatural. And so they want to change that. Something caused that. Something happened to you that causes that. They will give you the standards of child abuse or childhood trauma or overbearing mother. Those are all disproven and defunct theories, but you'll still hear it to this day. You were abused as a child. Your mother was overbearing. Your father was distant, all of those. And so something happened that turned you inside to desire someone of the same sex. And so they want to change that. Or at best teach you to control your desire so you don't act on it.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, do these conversion therapy programs consider the possibility of bisexuality existing or any other sort of sexual orientations that are in the spectrum that we are now starting to learn about? Because I don't know. I'm bisexual, and I'm wondering if I would have ended up in a conversion therapy program if it wasn't targeted towards any other sexuality that wasn't either lesbian or gay.
Yeah. In most conservative Christian circles, sexual orientation is black and white. There is heterosexuality. And that's it. Any variation of that is an aberration. So bisexuality, pansexuality, any other variation, being trans, any of that is an abnormality. It is not God's design, not God's intention. So yes, you would be a candidate for some kind of conversion therapy, just as somebody who says they are gay or lesbian. There's only one sexual orientation. So in many of the conservative groups, you cannot even call homosexuality a sexual orientation. It is a temptation. It is an aberration. You cannot call it a sexual orientation, because if you give it something that definitive, you're verging on saying it's unchangeable. It's just like when we were in conversion therapies, we could not say, I'm gay and I need to be changed. To admit that we were gay would be to own that identity. We would be taking our identity from our sin. So we would have to say, I struggle with the sin of homosexuality, or I struggle with homosexual temptations. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't own the sin. We couldn't take any ownership. And so we had to... It was all about how we said things. It's all about the wording.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. That I was going to say that makes sense, but if you know,
I've spent 40 years and it doesn't always make sense.
I have a question. Is it always, what about people that, let's say a male that may be effeminate, but it's not gay, say, would they be made to be converted simply to be or get these mannerisms, like to stop?
Sometimes, yes. And some of the very strict conservative churches that rely strongly on the King James Version of the Bible. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, the King James translates a Greek word as effeminate. And so they then would be targeted as not the way God designed. As I said, when I grew up in the South, we were supposed to act a certain way. You know, boys will be boys. And we can't act in any certain way. And so I can remember so often my father would say, why are you standing like that? Get your hand off your hip. Why are you walking that way? Don't hold your hands. Don't say that way. And so there is this expectation of acting a certain way. So effeminate boys don't have an easy place in the church. Regardless of their sexual orientation, it is their gender expression that then becomes a target for these kinds of programs. Mm-hmm. And we've had in many of the programs there were classes where you would train men how to be masculine and train women how to be feminine. I wished I could say this is satire, but it's really not. There are classes for women on how to put makeup on, how to wear their clothes properly. The support groups that I had been part of, there was an accountability factor among the attendants. And so if we were sitting a certain way, or if as we were talking, if my wrist went a certain way, there would be people in the group who would call me on it. Watch that wrist. Why are your legs crossed that way? And so there is this factor of there's a certain way to act that makes you masculine, and there's a certain way to act to be feminine. My father decided that I needed to be involved in sports because that would make me a man. And so we would get out in the backyard for hours and hours and hours and play pitch with the baseball. And I was forced to join a baseball team. And I couldn't just play baseball. I had to play baseball well. And I made all-star baseball. And to this day, I hate baseball with a passion. It's like, you know, that's just kind of the way it is. So it's just, it's perceptual, but it is all rooted in a certain understanding of what the Bible says.
That must make like the people who are subjected to this, it must make them feel really self-conscious about anything that they do, because if someone is going to tell you off for walking a certain way, or as you said, put your hands on your hips or whatever it may be, that must have like a really damaging effect on just one's own perception of themselves, I think.
Well, and I think that's one of the problems. And one of the problems with the entire premise of ex-gay programs is it is damaging to a person's self-image, self-esteem, self-worth. I mean, first you're being told that something is wrong with you. You were created wrong. Something happened to you. You're broken. You're broken. You need to be fixed. You're sick. You need to be healed. You're sinful. You need to be cured. And so you are inherently not worthy. You're not good enough in God's eyes, in the church's eyes. So that's damaging. And so if you go into one of these programs, and as I did, worked my ass off. I mean, I there's no exaggeration. If somebody said, this is what you need to do, Bill, I did it with all my heart. They said, you need to memorize Bible verses. I memorized entire books of the Bible. You need to pray. I prayed for hours. And so when somebody, when you try and try and try, and then inside you know it's still not working, that devastates you. you look at yourself and you say, there's something inherently wrong with me. And you're sitting in a support group with other people who are giving these wonderful glowing testimonies of what God did in their life and how victorious they've been this week. And you're sitting there going, what the hell is wrong with me? Why isn't it working for me? And so I went 8 years in these programs, from just attending to the point that I was an executive director of an ex-gay ministry. And I was speaking all over the country on television and radio programs and being quoted in magazines. And yet I would sit in these groups going, it doesn't seem to be working for me the way it's working for them. And I didn't ask the obvious question, is there something wrong with the program? I would ask, what's wrong with me? And so it's built on this insecurity, just like cults in general. That's how they control us, is there's something wrong with you and only we can fix you. And so if you question or you admit it's not working, then you will be quickly told it's not the program, it's you. You don't want it enough. You're not trying enough. You're not praying enough. You're not whatever. It's always the enough part. And so it is debilitating to a self-image and to your self-esteem. And that's why when people do end up realizing, like me, I was a slow learner. It took me 8 years. When I finally just walked away from it, I realized this is not working. Then within a week, I guess within 2 or 3 weeks later, I was in an apartment with a revolver in my lap, ready to end my life, because I had failed. I had failed my ministry. I had failed my family. I had failed God. I had failed myself. And that's what leads to the suicide that is so prominent in this. One of my dearest friends committed suicide when he could not finish his ex-gay program.
That is so horrible, Bea. I'm so sorry you had to struggle with that. I mean, I can't imagine how difficult that must have been for you and for anyone that has ever been in a conversion therapy program. I'm very, very sorry.
And that's the reason I've spent, you know, because I was in there in the early 80s. So I've been out for more than 30 years, but I've spent those 30 years speaking out about the programs, monitoring them, I write about it extensively to expose two key elements of these programs. How deceptive they are. They lie. They make all these promises and they lie. And then secondly, how dangerous they are, because at best, and I use that word loosely, at best, they will just destroy a person's self-esteem. At worst, they will destroy the person.
Yeah, it makes you wonder just how many people kind of faked it and, you know, just went to the meetings and said, I've done this wonderful, well, God has done this wonderful thing for me. And in reality, probably everyone was struggling almost in the same way.
Well, in the 30 years since leaving, I have met hundreds of people who said just exactly that. I've met hundreds of people who were in even some who were in my program back home in Birmingham. And surprisingly, I've met many other gay, ex-gay leaders of these groups and ministries, people that I looked up to in my life. I would say, why is it working for him and it's not working for me? And 25 years later, I find out that same person's looking around going, why is it working for them and not for me? We were all asking the same questions, but we weren't in a safe enough space to admit that we had these questions, to admit that we had these doubts, because honestly, fundamentalism does not create safe spaces for questions and doubts. Fundamentalism is the ultimate expression of cognitive dissonance. And so you don't want to ask hard questions. You don't want to say, you know, this is not working. This doesn't make sense. And so we just have to parrot what we were told. Of course, we were told that if, you know, faith was saying what we want to happen, not what is happening. And so that creates a delusional environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like in these sessions that I've done, I've seen so many different like speakers and people in the audience just saying the same thing over different aspects of religion, and that everyone was struggling, believing that they were the only ones who were struggling and that everyone else had it all figured out and they were the only ones who just, you know, they weren't worthy or they didn't pray enough or whatever the case may be. So it's just, I don't know, it's just really horrific and also weird and just interesting to see how religion has created the same kind of fake narrative in everyone that works because nobody shares everything and everyone yeah. believes that it works, but it doesn't really.
It's a circular logic that we've all seen. If any of us were involved in conservative religion, there is this circular logic. The Bible says this, so we do this because the Bible says that. And so there is the circular reasoning that goes into it. Our culture, our environment, our parents, our church, everything around us told us we needed to fit in. We needed to be like everybody else. So there was a lot of pressure to do it. Mm-hmm. It was very different when I was going through it in the 80s. We didn't have Google. I mean, honestly, we didn't know the things that we didn't have the access. So I didn't know that there were people out there who had gone through it and come out of it and realized what a crock of crap it was. We didn't have access to that. So, we had to take things pretty much on face value. We listened to the wonderful glowing testimonies of people who said, this worked for me. And you say, okay. And anything that didn't fit into that, we kind of filed away. The classic example of cultism. We just filed it away going, okay. I mean, I went one time, somebody told me about a form of therapy that if I would go do that, it would help me in my journey to overcome these feelings. And it was kind of a, what they called at the time, inner healing. Mm-hmm. And so I went to this guy who was a practitioner and I was laying on a sofa and he's talking. It was probably essentially boiled down to a kind of hypnosis that he would talk and kind of get me more and more and more relaxed. And helping me to relive past traumas, some traumas I didn't even know I had. And so it was supposed to be bringing up all this childhood trauma, and then we could heal that, and it would help me to be to overcome these feelings. And mm-hmm. so we're about halfway into it, and I was kind of in a relaxed state. I mean, he had this droning voice, and I was kind of settling in. When I realized all of a sudden his hand was on me in a place that his hand should not be.
Oh my God.
And so, you know, and even with that, I walked out of there going, well, he didn't get it right, but I didn't just walk away from the whole thing. I just thought, well, he's wrong. So it is a hard mindset to break from. I mean, ex-gay programs, it's a cult. Mm-hmm. The mindset is a cult.
Yeah. Well, I definitely wasn't expecting that twist in that story. So, wow, that's really bizarre.
I'm a fiction writer. I do write twists.
Well, this was very real. So,
oh, yeah, too real.
Yeah. So, obviously, only if you're comfortable. But I just wanted to ask you about like your personal experience in conversion therapy, and obviously, you have talked a bit about that. So if there's anything else that you wanted to add, now's the time. And then I also wanted to know how you came out of it. You know, what was the process?
As I said, I began to, when I came into the Christian faith, I got involved in this extreme fundamentalism group, and they were very harsh. They were very clear about homosexuality. So I began to do research, and that's when I learned that there were programs and people out there who promised they could fix this. And I went to a workshop in my hometown. I saw an ad for a workshop from, strangely enough, from the Anita Bryant Ministries. Anita Bryant was very big at the time with her Save Our Children campaign. And her organization had a guy come in and he told his story of coming out of homosexuality. So I went, I sat in the back of the room, and afterwards there were some literature. I didn't sign in. I wasn't about to sign in. I was married at the time, because I got married at a very, very young age. So young, my parents had to sign for me to get married, but I was convinced that was going to help. You know, that would fix things. If I could just get married, it would be normal after that. So I didn't sign in, but on the back table, there was a brochure and literature from Exodus International. And so I wrote to them and began to get literature, and then began to write to some of the leaders and built up a friendship with several of the leaders, went to a couple of their conferences, and just began to talk to other people about what I was going through, that I was working on this, that I was trying to overcome my own sin of homosexuality. And when I use that word, I don't see homosexuality as a sin. This is the terminology of my past. But as I began to tell, then other people began to come to me going, okay, I feel this too. What can you do to help? Or parents or pastors began to send people to me. So we kind of started our own little support group, which then grew to its own ministry. And so we started our own ministry in Birmingham, and I was the executive director, in addition to being pastor of a 600-member church. So then, because I was doing this, all of a sudden I was, people said, oh, you need to talk to Bill. He's overcome this. And so Christian TV stations began to call me. Christian radio stations began to call me. National evangelists, if I mentioned their names, you would know their names, began to call me. We hear that you know how to do this. Somebody on our staff, or this pastor friend of mine. And so all of a sudden I was in demand. And I was in a position where I wasn't sure how to say, well, I'm still struggling with all these questions. All of a sudden I'm in the spotlight. And when you're in the spotlight, you have to kind of keep, you know, I don't think I was intentionally lying. I've been accused of intentionally lying to people, but I wasn't. I was just so deceived that I was saying what I was supposed to say. I wanted it to be true so badly that I said what I was told to say. And I did this for, as I said, like 8 years. And then through a series of events, both in the church that I was pastoring, because we grew from a church of about 90 to a church of over 600 in a span of 4 or 5 years, I just kind of burned out. A dear friend of mine that I went to seminary with committed suicide. One of the guys in our ex-gay support group was diagnosed with AIDS. And he left the group. He went home because he was so sick. And we learned that he had AIDS and had very little time left. And I called his mother, and I was his pastor as well as his group leader. And I wanted to come by and see him. And his mother said, it's too late. I can't remember her exact words, but she was basically saying, he's committed the unpardonable sin. He will die and spend eternity in hell because of his sin. And she wouldn't let me come and see him as his pastor. And he died with that in his head, that his mother had told him that he was unworthy, that he was unforgivable. And it broke my heart. And the combination of those two just kind of wore me down. And I decided to take a short leave of absence from my church and my ministry, and just kind of pulled away and did some thinking, and honest looked at myself and said, you know, I've done everything they told me to do for 8 years, and nothing's changed. Nothing has changed. The desires are still there. I have terminology to talk about it. I have tricks to ignore it. But nothing has changed. And I just realized that I couldn't do it anymore. And that week I resigned my church, and my wife and I separated. And that's when I got this small apartment and made all the plans to end my life, because I had lost everything. My family, my church, my career, my self-esteem were gone.
Yeah. I'm so sorry about that. I mean, it's such a heartbreaking thing to hear, and it's such a, it kind of shows how extreme the results of these programs are, and not just the programs, but the whole culture of the churches. So yeah, I'm just so sorry that you had to go through that, that your friend had to go through that. This is really, really heartbreaking.
It is, and not every experience is dramatic and drastic, but I think the end results are still traumatic. Mm-hmm. I think it is still demeaning to a person. Yeah. And so I don't like to paint my experience as, you know, every person who goes through it is going to end up suicidal. But I just don't think you're going to go through it and come out with a healthy self-esteem.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how could you? Like, that's, it's programmed to not make you come out.
Yeah, true.
That.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that makes perfect sense. So I guess if it's possible, in a more of a hopeful note, my follow-up question would be, how did you come out of this sort of dark place? Because, I mean, it's hard enough to give up 8 years of life experiences, of beliefs and everything. So I guess that took like a process of coming out and just seeing the light, quote unquote.
Yeah. And it was almost a longer process, 8 years in the program. Then when I decided to walk away from it, I had been so programmed, because within these groups, when somebody would leave, they were gone. They were dead to us. And so I knew that if I were making this decision to walk away from the ex-gate, attempting to transform my orientation, I was essentially turning my back on my faith. I had to turn my back on my family and my ministry. I would never do ministry again. That's all I had trained for. And so it was this process of my whole world was gone. The night that I was sitting there with the gun in my hand, the things that were in my head was my kids. I had two kids at the time, and the family of my friend who had committed suicide. I remember being at his funeral and seeing the trauma that his family had gone through. And I just sat there. I was pretty drunk at the time, but I was thinking, I don't want to put my family through that. Mm-hmm. So I put the gun away and decided that, I needed to try to find something to put my life together. So I began looking for a job, which I did find. And within about a year, I was able to move from the city that I was born and raised in and had done this ministry and where I was so well known. I got a job in another state, across the country. So I was able to go and kind of reinvent myself. Now I'm in my late 30s by now. I'd been married for 19 years. I got married at 18. I never dated that much. I'd been married for 19 years. And so now I've not only got to learn to date, I've got to learn to date men. I lived in Southern California where everybody is gorgeous. And so it was, it was culture shock, but I had an opportunity then to begin to figure out who I was, not as trying to change for other people. And so I did my coming out at age 38.
It's never too late.
It's not, you sometimes feel like you're on a treadmill going really, really fast. But I found a wonderful, wonderful group of supportive people in Southern California who embraced me and loved me and were there for me. And it really was helpful for me to just kind of, I'd never been to bars. I was a Southern Baptist. We don't go to bars. So, first time going to bars and these kinds of things. So it was a learning experience, but it took years of reading materials, going to workshops and seminars, just to try to unlearn this these tapes that were in my head that I would just hear, that would, you know, somebody would say something or I'd hear something and it would just trigger all of these feelings of inadequacy and failure. So it took years to overcome that. Lots of therapy. God bless therapists who will just listen to you and let you say these things, but then help you to feed them back to yourself in different ways. And so it was a very, very long process.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised, especially having spent so much time, not just being a random believer, but also so immersed in these programs to the point that it was your job. I can't imagine how long that would take for myself and so many others. So, I mean, the fact that you're here today having a talk with us about having overcome this, I think that's just amazing and definitely worth celebrating. So is there any other topic that you wanted to cover about conversion therapy? Any other thing that you wanted to just talk about?
Well, I want to emphasize that it's still practiced. I mean, I know that we have cities and states and communities who are passing laws banning the practice of conversion therapy, particularly for minors. Mm-hmm. And I'm in favor of it. I support it. I work with, I've spoken to it. I'm a part of an organization and we push for that. One of my friends, I noticed his online, and that's one of the things that he and his group do is pushing for this. If I had my way, it would be outlawed for everybody, not just minors. But it just is applied to the professional communities. These laws apply to licensed psychiatrists, psychologists, and counselors. They don't apply to the pastor in the Fundamental Baptist Church down the street. They don't apply to the executive director of the ex-gay camp down in South Texas. These laws, because of our separation of church and state, don't apply to these people. And so there is still ex-gay programs and treatments going on. I know we call it conversion therapy now. I'm old school. We called it ex-gay. But it's still going on, and it's sometimes underground, but it's still going on. And the practices are, they vary from pseudo psychological, pseudo scientific, but it's all been debunked. There is not a single mainstream medical or mental health organization that supports conversion therapy. They've all come out with statements opposing the concept of conversion therapy and changing sexual orientation. It is still strictly tied to a conservative religious faith. Mm-hmm. So that is the change that's going to have to take place for conversion therapy to go away. So anytime a city or a state adopts a ban on it, I'm in favor of it, because maybe one more parent will say, oh, well, maybe I need to think twice about this. But it's not going to prevent them from taking their son or daughter to their pastor or sending their son and daughter to a conversion camp. So it's progress, but it's not the full solution.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I mean, the fact that it's still legal nowadays in the United States is just mind-blowing. In any state, like, I don't know, it's just, some things just they're mind-blowing to me still today. Yeah.
And the practices vary from, you know, just praying to casting out demons to, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. the bizarre to the sublime, but the message is still very, very clear. There's something wrong with you in God's eyes and in the eyes of the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so, so much, Bill, for these lovely presentations. We have a few questions. So even if the presentation has been roughly 10 minutes shorter than usual, I think that's great because we have a lot of questions. So that gives us plenty of time. So if it's okay with you, I'm just going to go and start with Q&A or perfect. So the first question is kind of a two-question. And so someone asked, what kind of things do go on in these conversion therapy programs? And then a follow-up question to that is whether if conversion therapy is done the same way for men and women, is there any sort of difference or gender segregation there?
There is no uniformity of methodology. It varies. Like as I said, I've been to programs where it's all about demons. You are inhabited by a demon of homosexuality. So we have to cast out the demon of homosexuality. And so I've been in those services. I've been in the services where, you know, you get anointed with oil. I've been in the services where it depends on some of the theology of the founder, because again, these organizations tend to grow up around a person and personality. So if I realized that jogging 10 miles a day helped me to overcome my feelings of same-sex attraction, then I'm going to start a jogging camp and everybody's going to jog and that's going to help everybody. Okay. Clearly, that is not what I do. But it does vary from person to person. And so as I've monitored these over the years, there's just so many variations because, like, you know, in the one of the advantages of like the American Bar Association and the American Medical Association is they have some kind of control over the practices. You can't be a member of the American Bar Association and just do whatever you want. There are guidelines, there are practices, there are principles to follow. Yeah. Within the ex-gay world, even when there was Exodus, which was kind of this umbrella organization, the groups that were under it, and there were hundreds of them, were individual ministries and groups and organizations. They didn't have to follow any strict guidelines in order to be a part of Exodus. They still did their own thing. And there was infighting about how what's right and what's the best way and all of that. So there is no one way or right way to do it. And so since they didn't agree on a method of curing homosexuality, because they never even agreed on what causes it. If you listen to them, what causes homosexuality? The theories of it. I was told at one point that it could have been called by some second or third or fourth generation back. And so I needed to confess the sins of my great, great grandparents because that sin could have been passed on to me. So in other words, I didn't have a control over it. I'm gay because my great, great granddaddy slept with some guy.
Right.
And so if they can't agree on a cause of homosexuality and they can't agree on a method to cure it, you end up with all kinds of crazy things going on. Hug therapy. There are known cases. There was one prosecuted a couple of years ago of a therapist who would have his clients get naked in front of him and he would touch them, saying that that was going to help cure them. I think it helped him more than it helped them, but that's his issues. So, you know, there's no controls over these methodologies. And as far as the distinctions in gender, sometimes there were. The group that I led had off and on, occasionally we'd have a woman who would be a part of our coach, but it was predominantly guys. Some organizations are only men, and then some deal more with women. And as far as the causes and the practices, they would vary depending on the gender of the that they were dealing with.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I guess in my mind, at the beginning, they maybe didn't even consider the existence of female, just lesbian. So, mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that you had, I'm actually surprised that you had a woman in your group.
It was just occasional. And I found that in a lot of the mindset, and this is that I don't have any data to back this up. It was just talking with other leaders. We tended to view women and lesbians differently than men. There was a kind of a general rule I remember talking about one time in a group of other leaders at an Exodus conference that for men, it was more about the act of having sex with one another. And for women, it was more about the emotional connection to another woman. Now, mm-hmm. that's a generality and it's sexist as hell, but that's the way we kind of perceived it. That for women, their sexuality was more emotional based, the connection to another woman. But for men, it was physical. It was about hooking up with another person, another man. So we treated those differently.
I have some also from the chat. It's also one with a follow-up. I don't know actually how many, do we have any clean stats on this? Like how prevalent is the conversion therapy? Do we know how many people are exposed to it a year or how many programs there actually are?
Yes. There is, I was actually just reading an article that came out recently about the number of people that was estimated had gone through a conversion therapy program. And it was hundreds of thousands of people who it's estimated have gone through in some form or another this type of program. So it is prominent, but it can be kind of seen as underground because it is not something that churches will stand up at the pulpit and advertise. It's something that if a parent brings a child to their pastor, the pastor will say, oh, I know this program, or I know this person. And here's the stat. A research group at the UCLA School of Law estimates that 698,000 LGBTQ adults in the United States have received conversion therapy between the ages of 13 and 17. That's nearly 700,000 people have experienced this religious abuse. And I do think it's a religious abuse.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah. That makes, yeah, I feel like that's, yeah, for
it
sure.
It is.
There's a follow-up question to that one, I think. Isn't there, Madeline?
That was the follow-up also, how many programs there are was the follow-up.
Oh, and that varies as well. When Exodus was active and at their largest, there were, I think, a couple of hundred organizations that were under the Exodus umbrella, but not every person or organization was under the Exodus umbrella. Sometimes it's a single individual that practices it. Sometimes it's a group. They have a name, like the group that I was executive director of, we were called Coming Back. And so it was our organization. And then there were all kinds, some were large, some were small. Love in Action, which was up in the San Rafael, started in San Rafael, and then moved to Memphis. They were the largest ex-gay organization. I think up till recently was one of the few that still had, or maybe the last of the ones that still had a residential program. I don't know if you saw the movie Boy Erased that was big a couple of years ago. That movie is based on one young man's experience at Love in Action. It's a fictionalized account of his story, but that took place at Love in Action. So our program did not have residentials, and many programs didn't have residential. But for younger kids, there are still gay camps that parents can send their kids to. And so it could be a week, 2 weeks, sometimes a month. And those are still around.
That's a shame. So another question that we have is whether the spread of HIV and AIDS was used as a tool to kind of draw people in to conversion therapy programs, which I'm going to assume is a yes. But.
Yeah, absolutely. Because they began to grow in the 70s. And then as we moved into the 80s, which is when I came into it, AIDS was used as a recruiting device and as a scare tactic. If you leave us, you'll go get AIDS. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to get AIDS, come in and we'll help you fix it. So AIDS was a prominent factor. I think in the early recruiting of it, and so we had this whole mentality of I don't want to get AIDS, so I need to stop having sex. To stop having sex, I need to control these desires.
Okay, yeah, I feel like that was expected awfully, but yeah, that makes sense in that.
There always needs to be in conservative fundamentalism. There needs to be the fear factor. That's a controlling touch point. There has to be something, whether it's hell or AIDS or anything. There has to be. That's how we're controlled.
And are you aware of any scientific groups or researchers that are focusing on refuting conversion therapy? Because obviously it has been, I guess, denied previously in the past. But is there any like research groups that have like lead the way or currently trying to make this even more so obvious that it doesn't work?
There are studies. There have been studies that periodic, you know, going ongoing. I wish there were more of a single location for all of it. There's a lot of great LGBTQ organizations out there who kind of serve as a repository for some of this information. And so you can find it there. My friend Michael is here and he works with Born Perfect, and they have a lot of the information on their website. There are, you know, most of your major organizations, HRC, even Southern Poverty Law Center has some really good resources on their website. Truth wins out. They've been doing that for a really, they've been doing this monitoring for a really long time. When I first started doing it, they were already doing it. So there is the material out there. And occasionally you'll get like the UCLA study that I quoted earlier. They will do commission studies on different elements of this. And so it's there, and you know, and the people who are proponents of ex-gay will point to their own programs and their own studies. There's not the validity, and I'm not just saying this because I'm on the other side. There's just not the same validity to it. It's not, it doesn't have the research. It you know, when you start with a premise, being gay is wrong. The Bible says being gay is a sin. If it's a sin, it can be changed. Let's find proof of that. And so that's been one of my contentions for years, is when you hear people say, you can change, other people have changed, and you'll listen to their marketing programs and you read their marketing materials and their website, and it's glowing and it's wonderful. But if you read carefully, it tends to be very vague. Multitudes of people have changed. Hundreds of lives have been changed. But if you get into specifics, what is your success rate? What is, and so you get into the specifics, then it boils down to people who go through the program will say, I am changed, or I have less temptation. And so they say, well, let's chalk that up into our statistics for a success. Well, you know, I can say anything, and I did for 8 years, but that doesn't prove anything. It's not verifiable. And so those kinds of personal experiences, I can say that, you know, an angel took me up and flew me around the house last night. That's my experience, but it's not verifiable. And yeah. So when you listen to people talk about their own experience, you have to realize that's not, it is their experience, but you can't validate it. You can't verify that. And that is not the basis of evidence and research.
Well, thank you so much for your answer, Jeff.
It was a long answer, I know.
No, I loved it. I think it sends the perfect message. It's just, we shouldn't tolerate this at all in any way, shape, or form. And I think we only have time for one last question. So Madeline, I'm just going to let you choose that one.
Yes, I got this one on the chat here. Having experienced shock and aversion techniques during conversion therapy has led to inability to connect with others. What skills would you suggest to help address that issue besides therapy, which they're already attending?
So let me make sure I understand.
They experience shock and aversion techniques and they're having an inability to connect with others. So it's any kind of tips outside of therapy, if you're able to provide any.
That's a hard one because I did not go through that. And I can imagine, I'm not even sure I can imagine the trauma of that and the sense of disconnection that comes with that. If the person is in therapy, then I think that's a great place to start. Beyond that, finding people that maybe have gone through it as well, talking to them. There are people out there. There are Facebook groups of people who have gone through this, survivor groups that have gone through these ex-gay programs, and they kind of support one another. And I think that, and they're powerful. The survivor group, those helped me. I was in a survivor group for several years, helped lead a survivor group for several years as well. So I would definitely recommend that, because other people have experienced something along the same lines. Aversion therapy and shock therapies are rare. We think they're more rare today than they were back in the 1900s and beyond, but we're under no illusions that they don't still occur.
And they are legal.
Yes.
Like, it's not done illegally, I mean.
Yeah.
It's practice.
Yeah. It's, electroshock therapy is supposed to be done by trained technicians. Mm-hmm. But we've seen that, even trained technicians can have this underlying mindset that impacts their practices.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for giving this fantastic presentation today. I loved getting to know you and just knowing your experience and all your expertise. So I can't thank you enough. I don't know what time is there, but I'm sure it's very late. So
no, it's, I'm good. I just, if anybody has any questions for me, I mean, my website, I think somewhere along the, my website is there, and I have a blog, and I write about this extensively, and so you can see other things that we weren't able to cover, and I deal with that in the blog that's on my website and in my other writings. There's ways to contact me on my website if you have specific questions, and I will certainly try to answer them if I can. Couple of books. There's not a lot of books. I mean, the books that I write are fiction. I write fiction, but my experiences in the ex-gay world comes into the fiction that I write, but there are some people who have written some fairly good books on the subject of ex-gay, their own personal experiences and just some general overviews of it. And I've given some of those that you might want to check. Some of them are harder to find in print these days.
Perfect, thank you. And thank you also so much, Madeline, for co-hosting with me today. Since Eric isn't here, I really, really appreciate your help. So thank you so much.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There, you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.